From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Donald Trump, James Comey, and rising temperatures on Capitol Hill.
I rise today, Mr. Speaker, to call for the impeachment of the President of the United States of America.
No one ought to, in my view, rush to embrace, you know, the most extraordinary remedy that involves the removal of the president from office.
Also today, a new Harvard study suggests that we've overestimated the size of today's hookup culture.
The great majority of people aren't interested in casual sex. You know, they would prefer to spend time with friends, spend time alone, have sex in a serious relationship.
Plus, the Celtics just keep winning. Number one seed going into the Eastern Conference Finals tonight. Number one pick in the draft. We'll see if Bill Littlefield thinks they can take things all the way to winning an NBA title. That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Washington, D.C. feels as if it's at a virtual standstill as the White House and Congress struggle to deal with the fallout from the latest revelation about the Trump administration. Yes, I'm talking about that New York Times story that dropped last night, reporting that the president privately asked former FBI Director James Comey to drop investigations into the former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. Meanwhile, no tweets from the president today so far. Trump was in New London, Connecticut, giving the commencement address to the U.S. Coast Guard Academy.
Look at the way I've been treated lately, especially by the media. No politician in history, and I say this with great surety, has been treated worse or more unfairly. You can't let them get you down. You can't let the critics and the naysayers get in the way of your dreams.
The president made no specific mention of the current controversies engulfing his White House, but he did add,
I didn't get elected to serve the Washington media or special interests. I got elected to serve the forgotten men and women of our country, and that's what I'm doing.
Well, let's turn to Ed O'Keefe, congressional reporter for The Washington Post. He joins us now from Washington. Ed, welcome to Radio Boston.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
All right. So it's hard to believe that it was just a little over a week ago that President Trump fired FBI Director James Comey. And here we have now the Times report yesterday about notes or memos that Comey has written documenting a meeting that he had with the president where the president supposedly asked him to cease investigations or drop investigations into Michael Flynn. So much going on in just 7 days. I mean, what is the mood in Washington today?
The mood is, let's see those memos. And at this point, three congressional committees are asking for them. The House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, which has broad jurisdiction over the entire federal government and subpoena power. It has scheduled a hearing for next Wednesday in hopes that Director Comey will come testify, and they're seeking all those documents. The Senate, Judiciary, and Intelligence Committees are also investigating all of this and have also invited Comey to come speak publicly about what he knew and his involvement in this whole affair. So, in other words, Congress is doing its job. It's trying to get to the bottom of this using its powers as an oversight branch to try to figure out exactly what the president did, why he did it, and what the president and the former FBI director discussed regarding the ongoing Russia investigation, which is also being investigated by House and Senate committees.
So Jason Chaffetz, who's the head of the House Oversight Committee, actually just under an hour ago, noted what you were talking about, that he's officially noted a hearing for next Wednesday with former FBI Director Comey. But Chaffetz tweeted, I still need to speak with him. Evidently, he has a new phone number, so we'll see if Chaffetz can get a hold of Comey. But another thing that Chaffetz has done is, you mentioned the House and Senate committees requesting copies of these memos that Comey supposedly has written and any tapes of the conversations between the president and former director Comey. Chaffetz has also been saying that if those are not forthcoming by next Wednesday, he's ready to use his subpoena power, right?
Yep. And so are the other committees as well in the Senate. This is a common threat that they issue, and sometimes they have to issue those subpoenas, sometimes they don't. We'll see. Senators have told me and other reporters up here that they have gotten the indication from Comey that if he comes to testify to the, at the Capitol, he'd like to do it publicly. He'd like to do it in public view. It would be something that we all could watch and listen to. Senators agree that that's an appropriate way for him to do it. It may be that the Senate Intelligence Committee, which conducts most of its work in secret, might need to speak with him in a more classified setting, a more private setting, about a few matters. But given that the Judiciary Committees in both chambers and the Oversight Committee in the House have direct oversight responsibilities of the Justice Department and the FBI, those would be the places where he'd speak. If I were to guess, and I don't like to guess too often, but I've followed Congress long enough to know, it's likely that he would probably come testify to a Senate committee first and then make his way over to the House. And inevitably, Comey or his attorneys are probably going to make these arrangements with the various committees to make sure that he can do this in a way that is manageable, not only for himself, but frankly for the nation, because we know we'll be watching with bated breath.
Now, White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer spoke to the press gaggle aboard Air Force One just this afternoon, and he reiterated something from that was along the lines of the statement that the White House released last night, that it does not believe that the memo, the reported memos, are an accurate description or representation of what happened. And Spicer also said the president is confident in the events that he has maintained, and he wants the truth and these investigations to get to the bottom of the situation. I mean, how is, you've been in Washington for a while, how do you feel the White House is handling this latest revelation?
Not much differently than it has in the past, frankly. You know, it seems to deny these things, and you know, it doesn't outright deny that this was a topic of conversation, but clearly there's an issue with word choice and semantics here. I think it's important for people to remember, FBI agents, whether they're the director or somebody at the Boston field office, are trained and expected to be keeping copious notes of conversations, especially ones that may become part of an investigative file or a criminal case. In this case, that's what it looks like Comey was doing, and he has a history, apparently, of writing memos about sensitive subjects or issues that he thought might come up again. He did it in this case. But FBI agents apparently keep copious notes, are prolific writers of memos, and they hold up in court. So that shows you how legally sound they can be. They have held up in court before in the sense that if an FBI agent's notes or memos are needed as evidence, judges have accepted them. So that should give folks a sense of how critical this kind of writing can be. And given that Comey works for an agency that does this, it should be no surprise that he was doing this. A credit to our colleagues who've been chasing this stuff that probably knew that if he was keeping with the traditions of the FBI, he was likely keeping a paper trail.
Right. Now, finally, Ed, you know, Democrats, of course, will seek to press the White House and the president in whatever way they can. But what's the reactions from, you know, various wings of the Republican Party? We've been seeing reports of congressmen, you know, fleeing from reporters or refusing to answer questions or ducking into elevators. I mean, what is going on with Republicans on the Hill?
Well, that's a day that ends in Y. Members of both parties duck and cover and avoid us on all sorts of issues. In this case, I'm actually kind of struck at the Republican response so far, because you are seeing it happen perhaps in predictable corners, but it's happening a lot faster than it might normally. And I think it's because they're beginning to realize there is something clearly here that has to be investigated. It runs the range. You've had, for example, the Republican senator from Pennsylvania, Pat Toomey, suggest that the next FBI director should be somebody who is a Democrat, or somebody who has a Democratic voting record, or perhaps is a former Democratic politician. That's notable from a rather conservative Republican senator. You have several members of the House who are Republicans and probably will face difficult re-elections in swing districts next year, who've already come out and said, we need an independent prosecutor, or we need a congressional commission. We need to get to the bottom of this as fast as we can. There are those who stand by the president, say this is much ado about nothing and that it is having no effect on the party or their ability to do work right now. We'll see how many of those people are still there if these revelations continue to come out.
Ed O'Keefe is congressional reporter for The Washington Post. Ed, thank you so very much.
Great to be with you guys. Take care.
Well, let's hear how House Speaker Paul Ryan reacted today when he was asked if he believed the president may have been trying to influence or intimidate former FBI Director James Comey. Here's Ryan's response.
We have an obligation to carry out our oversight regardless of which party is in the White House. And that means before rushing to judgment, We get all the pertinent information. The House Oversight and Government Reform Committee has appropriately requested this memo, and I'm sure we're going to want to hear from Mr. Comey about why, if this happens as he allegedly describes, why didn't take action at the time?
Well, Democratic Senator Tim Kaine took a very different view. He told CBS this morning that he does see a connection to the firing of James Comey last week.
I view firing the FBI director and, when asked, essentially admitting I'm doing it because of the Russia investigation. If that's not an effort to impede or undermine the investigation, what is? Especially if he had earlier asked him, hey, drop this Flynn and Get investigation, and Director Comey refused to.
Well, joining us now with some unique perspective is Chuck Hagel. He served as Secretary of Defense under President Obama. He was also a Republican senator from Nebraska from 1997 to 2009. He was also chair of the President's Intelligence Advisory Board from 2009 to 2013, and he joins us from Washington. Secretary Hagel, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much.
So what do you make of all that's been going on in these past 7 days? I mean, what's your reaction to this news?
Well, I'm not sure that Orson Welles could have written a script like this, but it is the reality of what we are living with right now. I thought a lot of Ed O'Keefe's comments were particularly pertinent here. What I have noted as I have observed all of this and knowing a little something about this business from my background. I served for 8 years on the Select Committee on Intelligence in the Senate as well. And starting with being a young chief of staff to a Republican congressman during Watergate, I've seen these kinds of things go up and down over the years. And I don't know how many people are ready to jump right into the Watergate boat on this, but one of the
Well, actually, Secretary, if I may just interrupt here for a second. I mean, since you did mention the W word, Senator John McCain just last night was speaking with CBS's Bob Schieffer, and here's what he had to say.
I think it's reaching the point where it's of Watergate size and scale and a couple of other scandals that you and I have seen. It's a centipede that the shoe continues to drop. And every couple of days, there's a new aspect of this really unhappy situation.
Secretary Hagel, the senator also talked about Iran-Contra as well. But, I mean, the Watergate analogies are coming even from folks that you know really well.
No, they are. Absolutely. And what I was going to say, and actually John kind of made the point for me, was that although Watergate and Iran-Contra and some of these other issues that we've dealt with since the early 70s differ in players' specific dynamics, the storyline is the same, and it always will be with the kind of government, thank goodness, that we have, and that is a government of three co-equal branches of government, and the storyline always plays out obstruction of justice. And when you follow what Ed was talking about, what you were talking about, what's been in the papers you asked about the last week, and the comments that you ran from Kaine and the Speaker, that's where this train is headed, because that is the defining dynamic here. Was the president involved? Did he, in fact, try to obstruct any part of justice? And the other part of what's going on here, when you ask me the larger question over the last 5 months, is the continued erosion of the coin of the realm of any leader, and that is confidence and trust.
Right.
And what we've seen over the last 5 months is the daily erosion of that confidence and trust in everything the president says, the White House says, what comes out of the White House. Now, one or two or three things with a new president, I don't think that unravels a presidency. But the consistency and the big issues here that have played out and continue to play out and get more complicated and deeper and wider, they affect our international relationships. They affect our ability to govern. I mean, we're paralyzed, completely paralyzed. When you get into one of these situations, what happens in a White House is the daily circle the wagons effort and mentality. And that means there's no energy, focus, leadership, resources for anything other than just basic survival. And so tax reform, regulatory reform, immigration reform, all the other things that the president talked about, got elected on, are gone.
Yeah.
And the other piece of that is the political piece. At the same time, you're seeing the fraying, the very serious and consistent fraying of his own political party base.
Yeah.
And you mentioned some of it, and he can't govern that way. So something's going to have to happen here, and I don't know how this ends, but probably not. It does not end well.
So let me just ask you, because I just want to get right to a question which all of a sudden more and more people are asking out loud. I mean, Representative Justin Amash of Michigan, a Republican, just yesterday or today, he said that if these allegations are indeed true, that they, in his view, constitute grounds for impeachment. Do you agree?
Well, I mean, I don't know enough about the facts, and we are, especially when we start talking about articles of impeachment against the President of the United States, they certainly have to be based on facts. So whether we get to that or not, but we will get to that one way or the other. I mean, just the process that now is underway, bringing Comey up, both publicly and privately on these committees, the big question that's hanging right now, and you ask it, the memo. Is there such a memo? Is there more? And by the way, that doesn't even include the ongoing investigation that the FBI has right now and has had, as well as the Senate Intelligence Committee and the House Intelligence Committee, on the collaboration, was there collaboration between the Trump campaign people, his government, and the Russians. This is even separate from that, separate, not totally, of course, because it is the centerpiece of the latest flap, the memo, so on, was the Flynn issue and the dynamic. So it is all woven into the fabric.
Secretary Hagel,
once you get these things going, you can't stop them, and you will get to a conclusion, and you will get to some finality.
Right. So I wanted to jump in there because, you know, one thing that's undergirding all of this news and these controversies that have erupted over the past week is that someone is telling these reporters that, right? And back in February of just this, earlier this year, February 2017, you had a really interesting interview with New York Magazine, and there was something you said about leaks which I thought was highly, highly observant. You said that you found that leaks come as a result of people believing that they've been shut up or shut off in institutions, and that things are happening too secretly and may be wrong. They feel obligated morally or patriotically to alert the media. I mean, given how many leaks we have here, it feels that there are a lot of people, in your, you know, along the lines of what you're saying, acting patriotically to do something in the manner that they can. This is a government that feels like it's in crisis.
Well, I tell you, I've been around a little bit. As I said, I started my business and political career, government career, actually in Vietnam in 1968, but I came to Washington in 71. And the one constant I have seen throughout my life is exactly what you just said. This country is made up of very patriotic Americans who believe in their country, in each other, and the system. And you can't shut them out or shut them up. And we have a system that allows us the outlets to do this. And you can minimize that, or you can criminalize that, or you can say it's unpatriotic or disloyal, but you take an oath of office to the Constitution of the United States. You don't take it to a president or a political party. And leaks will come as a result faster than anything else, as I said in that New York Magazine article and interview. When people feel that something as bad is going on, and it's clandestine, and it's wrong, and it's dishonest, you will find gushers of leaks.
Yeah. Secretary Hagel, I'm curious, do you feel like we're now in a position, edging toward a position, where the American people, in terms of, you called it, the trust, the coin of the realm in our democracy, are they being asked to choose between who they trust more, the President of the United States, the former director of the FBI? I mean, and if that is indeed the case, what impact does that have on our democracy and the institutions that support it?
Well, first, our institutions will weather any individual or group of individuals, and I truly believe that. That's first. But second, the reality of your question, and I think is a very good question, and it in many ways will come down to just exactly that equation. Who do you trust? Do you trust the president or Comey on this? Well, what's going to happen here is that Comey's either going to have to produce through subpoenas or some way some evidence of what his associates have claimed. And again, I go back to facts. We are a nation of laws. We are, in fact, fact-based. And you can have the politics of it and all the rest that goes into it. It certainly is imperfect. But in the end, we have a system that's based on those realities, those facts. So I will always bet on the Constitution, the structure of the Constitution, co-equal branches of government, and the very fiber of the American people to get through this and do the right thing. I think we're in for a bumpy time here for a while. Mm. I mean, this is all going on, remember, at a time in the world that is about as volatile and uncertain as we've seen since World War II.
Right.
I don't know when we've seen anything more volatile and uncertain in the world today. And that's a world that depends on steady, wise American leadership that people can count on. You may disagree with us, may not like us for some reason, but people have the confidence in knowing and the trust in knowing that the United States is steady and most of the time does the right thing. I'm not sure they have that feeling about our country today.
Well, Chuck Hagel, he served as Secretary of Defense under President Obama. He was also a Republican United States Senator from Nebraska. He joined us today from Washington. Secretary Hagel, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Well, to the question of impeachment. Today, as I mentioned, House Republican Justin Amash of Michigan said if these allegations are true, they could be grounds for impeachment. On the House floor, Democratic Congressman Al Green of Texas went even further.
I rise today, Mr. Speaker, to call for the impeachment of the President of the United States of America.
But Green's party colleague, Democrat Adam Schiff, the ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee, urged calm.
I think that we ought to keep our focus on finding out the facts in the first instance, and no one ought to, in my view, rush to embrace, you know, the most extraordinary remedy that involves the removal of the president from office.
Well, let's get one more voice in here today. Massachusetts Congressman Stephen Lynch, he joins us now. Congressman, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Magna. How are you?
Well, busy, as is everybody here.
We all, yeah.
But let me just get straight to this question. Impeachment, do you think that we are looking at a situation where there may be grounds for impeachment?
There may be grounds, absolutely. I think that under current law, especially Section 1505 of 18 U.S.C., it describes an offense, a criminal offense, for someone to interfere with an ongoing proceeding with a corrupt purpose. And I think that, and again, depending on the facts, and we should do a thorough investigation, if those elements are met, and it certainly looks like it's very close to the line, that this would be an impeachable offense.
Hmm. So what do you think, then, is the role for House Democrats right now?
Well, we've actually asked, our committee has asked Jim Comey to come in next Wednesday at 9:30. I've called for this quite a while ago, but this morning, Chairman Chaffetz of the committee agreed. And so he has reached out to the former director, and we're going to have him in. We've asked him to bring any recordings, any memos that he has in his possession that are relevant to our inquiry. So we've got a lot to ask him about. You know, not only this memo and the request by the president allegedly to have him let go of the Flynn investigation, but also we want to talk to him about the investigation thus far. Regarding the Russian interference with our election, and also the circumstances surrounding his own firing. There seems to be a number of inconsistencies there on the part of the administration, a number of their officials, and then the president's own statements. So it may turn out to be a very interesting hearing and a very lengthy one.
Yeah. I mean, you well know that the question of obstruction of justice is a very thorny one, right? Because ultimately you have to, you know, the law has to prove intent in the
right
person who's charged. And I mean, That seems to be extraordinarily difficult in a case like this. I mean, how would you go about proving intent?
Normally, it would be very difficult, but this president has actually made pronouncements declaring what his state of mind was, saying that when I got rid of Comey, I was thinking about the Russian connection, and that this was a bogus or a made up investigation. So, in a number of occasions, he has expressed what his state of mind was. And you're right, the thorniest, the murkiest issue of an obstruction of justice charge is intent. But in this case, the president has actually, I think unwisely, made statements of his own state of mind when he made this decision, which is otherwise very difficult to determine.
So, Congressman, let me ask you a question that I've been asking everyone on the show over the past couple of days. Are you concerned with how these reports and revelations and what they might mean for the Trump administration? Are you concerned with what Secretary Chuck Hagel just said at the end of our last conversation, that it's having a profoundly negative impact on America's standing in the world and our ability to work with allies, et cetera?
Sure. So I think especially the possibility that President Trump may have disclosed classified intelligence, top secret intelligence to the Russians when we had obtained that intelligence through a cooperation agreement, I believe now is being reported was with the Israelis.
Yes.
But under the condition that we would not share it without their permission. And so that erodes the trust that certainly the Israeli intelligence community would be suspect of. And then it's also a lesson to others that venture to cooperate with the U.S. intelligence services. And also think about our own people who are out there, our own assets who are, in harm's way in difficult locations, be it, Syria or Pakistan or Afghanistan, who are doing great work. And this president doesn't seem to grasp the importance and the seriousness of the work that they're doing. There's an ongoing feud, I think, between the Trump administration and the 14 separate intelligence agencies that we have in our government.
Yeah. Well, it seems as if for now, though, we're in at least maybe a temporary holding pattern in terms of what we can all know about what actually happened until those memos, if they exist, and tapes, if they exist, come forth in the next couple of days. Stephen Lynch, Congressman from the 8th District of Massachusetts, thanks so much.
Thank you, Meghna. Good to be with you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We've all seen the headlines about hookup culture and young adults, but a new report from Harvard suggests that we overestimate the size of today's hookup culture. Turns out that perhaps 85% of young people said they prefer just hanging out with friends or being in a serious relationship. They prefer those things to hooking up. That's according to the report, The Talk, How Adults Can Promote Young People's Healthy Relationships and Prevent Misogyny and Sexual Harassment. It's based on interviews with 2,000 18 to 25-year-olds from across the country. Joining us now with more is Richard Weisbord. He's the lead author of the report. He's a psychologist and lecturer at Harvard's Graduate School of Education. And he's with us in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Great to be here.
So tell us, first of all, when we say hooking up, how do you actually define it?
Everything from making out to intercourse. So it's a wide range of things.
Okay. And so then you found that 85% of the young people that you surveyed, those 2,000 young people, prefer other options to that?
To casual sex. So to only about 4% said they were interested in hooking up. Some about 8 or 9% said they were interested in having casual sex with a friend. And, you know, it's very consistent with other data, too. I mean, one of the things that's interesting about this is that there's been good data about the percent of people who are hooking up for a long time. And, it, you know, it's much smaller than people think it is. People think it's two or three times bigger than it actually is. You know, about 8% of 18 to 25-year-olds are dating casually. The rest are in serious relationships or not dating at all. So, you know, we have big misconceptions about this.
So, what, I mean, obviously the first thought I have goes to blaming the media for some of those misconceptions, right? Because I feel like the way young people are portrayed in a lot of media is the casual hookup culture.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And I think this is, there are many factors here. One is the media and the hypersexualization of folks in the media. Another is, adults throughout history have always told stories about sex-crazed teenagers. That's not a new story. I think the hookup culture on college campus is very high profile, too. I mean, it's going on in at parties in very high profile ways. And it's a kind of, sort of a source of endless conversation. The college students we talked to were just as far off as the older adults about the size of the hookup culture.
Huh. So, I mean, before we get into some of the further details of your findings, I'm just curious. I mean, like, you did this study, you talked to 2,000 18 to 25-year-olds. I mean, what surprised you most about what they told you?
You know, we surveyed about 3,000 in total.
Yeah.
But I talked to, and my research team talked to scores of young people, too. I think there are a few things that surprised me. I mean, on the survey, one of the things that I just am still trying to get my mind around is 40% of people don't think that women are sexualized on television.
They don't.
No. that just seems sort of shocking to me and so obvious that women are sexualized on television. Almost 70% think there's either agreed or were neutral about the statement that there's too much attention to sexual assault. So that was a really sobering and surprising finding. We also find, large majorities of adults who are not talking to kids about basic things around consent. Uh-huh. That it's not okay to have sex to pressure somebody to have sex after they've said no. It's not okay to have sex with somebody who's severely impaired with alcohol. So those were, surprising and somewhat surprising and concerning findings. The last thing I'll just say really quickly on the good news front is we also found lots of young people, about 70%, who want to have more conversation with their parents about romantic relationships.
Right. So let's dig into all of those just a little bit deeper here because, about the first point that you made, that relates to the fact that you found a lot of misogyny in the survey results, right? 87% of women reported having experienced at least one in the fall during their lifetime, being catcalled, touched without permission, insulted with sexualized words, et cetera. And that made you conclude, or do you conclude from that young people are pretty desensitized to misogyny and harassment?
Well,
not the ones who are experiencing it, obviously.
I think there are a couple of different issues here. I do think there are a large number of young people who become desensitized when we talk to young people about this. I mean, first of all, in our interviews with young women, almost all of them say that they have been sexually harassed, and most of them have said they've been sexually harassed recently. So, I think this is really pervasive in a lot of young women's lives. But they also, what was discouraging is that we talked to a lot of young people and also a lot of educators, parents, who really didn't know what to do about it. And they said things like, it's just boys being boys, or if I intervene, it won't be effective, or I'll just be written off, or they're just being ironic. And, so it was discouraging how passive people feel about it.
Huh.
Words like I hit that and people calling each other bitch and hoe are just really common. And people just don't feel, most people we talk to in survey just don't feel like they can intervene in those situations.
So there's something that seems to link many of your findings here together. There's at least one common theme, and that is sort of a lack of communication between the young people that you talk to and their elders, parents, or other folks who might be a source of education and guidance on these things, right? Because 76% of respondents said they'd never had a conversation with their parents about how to avoid sexually harassing others. And then on the flip side of that, 70% of the folks responded said, as you'd mentioned earlier, that they wish they'd received more information about their parents' from their parents about some basic things like the emotional aspects of relationship and how to have more mature relationships.
Yeah. So I think those are, you know, two big takeaways from this report. One is that, 87% of young people are reporting being sexually harassed, but 76% have never had a conversation with their parents about how to avoid harassment. So that's a big disconnect. And, you know, as parents, I just feel like we have to have these conversations with our kids. I mean, it's just a super important thing to do. And a lot of them even don't even know really what harassment is. They think it's okay to catcall. That's the other thing that came up in our survey, or to touch somebody without permission. But on the good news front is this number of young people who want guidance around romantic relationships.
Right. But so, I mean, that just makes me wonder, like, in our culture's collective hyperventilating over young people, those young folks and hookup culture, it seems as if we're focusing on the wrong things, right?
You know, I think the real concerns about the hookup culture, there are harms that are going on in the hookup culture, like unprotected sex and higher rates of sexual assault. But I think that's right. I think the much bigger issue is these high rates of misogyny and sexual harassment, which are affecting very large numbers of kids, and our failure to prepare young people for love. I mean, a lot of young people in their 20s especially, are trying to figure out, can I have a healthy, mature, caring, lasting love relationship with somebody else? And, Freud says there are two things that are most important in life. One is work and the other is love. We do a lot to prepare young people for work. We have schools and many other institutions to prepare them for work. We do virtually nothing to prepare them for love, which may be the most important thing they do in their lives.
Is this significantly different than previous generations? Because, I mean, I don't imagine that any other previous generation got a lot of practical education on, how to have healthy relationships.
I don't think it's different than other generations. It's not true in other times in our history. There are other cultures, Norway, Australia, the Netherlands, where relationship education, some of those countries is compulsory in school. I mean, that they're much more focused on this than we are. And there are many cultures, there's some cultures where parents talk much more to their kids about these issues. But, one of the things that we're finding is, a lot of kids have grown up with parents who have divorced or who have been in miserable marriages or marriages with a lot of conflict. And, they're understandably anxious and, they want to talk about what's the difference between being infatuated and being in love? Why can I be attracted to people who are bad for me? I mean, these are great questions. They're like wonderful questions to talk to young people about. So I think we have a really great opportunity here. And I think we would learn a lot by having these conversations, too.
Yeah. So how do you start those conversations? Right. Because I think that's sometimes the hardest part. If the young person isn't coming to you with those questions.
Yeah. So it's a great question. So, I think one answer to that is it doesn't have to be a face to face sit down conversation.
You can do it over text.
Issues around love come up all the time, right? Like you're watching a TV show and you see some image of love that you just think makes you cringe and you just think is stupid. And, that's an opportunity to engage your child, your teen or your young adult in a conversation. Lyrics in music that you find really offensive. I think we have a responsibility, actually, in those situations to engage our kids and how they're interpreting, understanding those lyrics. So, it's kind of all around us. And I think if we're just mindful of those opportunities, we can have a lot of these conversations.
Yeah. I found some of the findings in your report quite inspiring and hopeful, right? Because I've come away with this feeling that young people are telling you that they want guidance and they want connection.
They want guidance. They want to talk to their peers. They want to talk to older siblings. They want to talk to parents, to educators. I think they want to talk to a lot of adults they respect. This is an incredibly daunting, complicated thing, right? Like to make a decision about, who you might want to marry or who you might want to be in a serious relationship with. And I think this is something that you sort of would expect young people would want guidance on.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, Richard Weisbord is lead author of this new report called The Talk. He's a psychologist and lecturer at Harvard's Graduate School of Education. And we'll have a link to the report at our website, radioboston.org. Thank you so much for coming in
today.
Thank
you. It's been a pleasure.
Back in just about 90 seconds, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back. It's Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Many school districts in Massachusetts are facing what observers call a crisis. As WBUR Edify reporter Tanya Mosley reports, there just aren't enough qualified superintendents to fill all the openings.
Good evening. I'd like to call our meeting to order.
It's spring, and the Peabody School Committee is about to interview another candidate for superintendent. The committee is looking for stability. The district has gone through four leaders in 10 years. But finding a qualified candidate has not been easy. Two of the six final candidates have already been snatched up by other districts. And just before this meeting in early April, Mayor Edward Betancourt has this disappointing news.
I did get a phone call yesterday from John O'Terry notifying me that he had been offered and he had accepted the Malden superintendent position Monday evening.
It's almost like free agency in baseball.
Peabody School Committee member Joe Amico.
You better give them a great offer when you do decide on who you want. And we didn't even get to that process. We only got through the initial interviews.
The Peabody District is far from alone in the challenge to find a qualified superintendent.
We have been watching somewhere in the vicinity of 55 to 65 superintendents turning over every year for the past 10, 12 years.
Tom Scott is executive director of the Massachusetts Association of School Superintendents. Scott says today you can expect a top school leader in Massachusetts to stay with a district about 5 to 7 years.
If you're in a district for 10 plus years, you've been in there for a long time.
Back when Scott was a superintendent in the late 90s, he says the average was 15 years. A change in the state pension system has led to many superintendents retiring earlier than they used to. And across the country, experts say the pool of candidates for these difficult jobs is declining. Scott's organization helps districts find potential candidates, and he says a decade ago, a superintendent job could garner 75 to 100 applications. Today, a posting might get about 30. Then there is the issue of scrutiny. Scott says, with increased budget constraints, school communities are less likely to be forgiving when they believe a superintendent has made a wrong decision.
You know, the way I describe it is the position has been so more politicized than it should be. Schools are a microcosm of society. We deal with many social issues that take place today. Our expenditure is the largest expenditure of most communities. So all of those factors weigh into the decisions that superintendents make.
Those important decisions, Diane Kelly knows all too well, and she enjoys making them. As the top leader of the Revere School District, her days and nights are consumed by her job.
Do you do this often where you're eating at your desk?
Every day.
Every day?
Yes.
No lunch break for you.
Each day, Kelly is in the office by 7 a.m. Most days are dominated by meetings with parents and staff. By 4 p.m.?
That's when I say, now I can do my work.
That's when Kelly begins her second leg of the day, writing policy and proposals or figuring out budgets. Then there are those evening events like committee and school meetings.
And I get home at about 8:30 or 9, and then it's eat something completely unhealthy that I can call dinner and take care of email from there and usually wrap it up, you know, about 10:30 or 11.
Despite the demanding schedule, Kelly loves it. And she was groomed for it by her old boss, former Superintendent Paul Dakin. She believes Dakin was contemplative in choosing her as the assistant superintendent during his tenure. In 20 years, there have only been three superintendents in Revere.
The important piece of that kind of continuity within the superintendency is that there's continuity in the values and the belief system of the school district.
One way to attract more candidates might be identifying and grooming them earlier, says Scott. He believes that could go a long way in helping to solve the shortage.
But we need to do more outreach. We don't tap. I call it tapping. You know, you approach someone, you say, you know, I think you really have these qualities. I would really encourage you to advance yourself in the direction of principal or superintendent of schools.
Back in Peabody, school committee member Joe Amico finds inspiration in Revere's ability to hire and retain superintendents.
I'd love to see that happen in Peabody where you have someone long-term because stability is good for students, it's good for parents, and of course it's good for teachers as well.
The committee has found a temporary solution. Instead of hiring a new superintendent, it has persuaded retired leader Herbert Levine to serve as interim head for another year.
Amico says the Peabody School District will start a new search in the fall with the hope that lessons learned from previous searches will lead to the perfect candidate.
That report from WBUR Edify reporter Tanya Mosley. Well, it is finally time for sports with Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Hi there, Bill.
Hey, Magna.
We saved the best for last today, okay?
Oh, I appreciate that.
Well, the Celtics are set to take on the Cleveland Cavaliers tonight at the Garden in Game 1 of the Eastern Conference Finals. But first, let's talk about another number one thing that the Celtics have, which is the number one draft pick. How'd that happen?
It's kind of thing one and thing two.
Yeah, exactly.
I remember those days. That happened because back in 2013, the Celtics made a trade with the Nets. The Celtics sent Kevin Garnett and Paul Pierce to the Nets, and the Nets sent a whole bunch of future draft choices to the Celtics. And boy, have the Celtics come out the winner on that particular exchange.
Yeah.
The Nets, of course, were trying to build an instant winner, and the Celtics went for youth and patience. And sure looks like they came out on top.
Well, Paul Pierce actually sent out a funny tweet last night taking credit for it, for the luck. He said it was his parting gift to the Celtics.
Yeah, very nice. Thank you, Paul.
But of course, so they've got a pick, right? They've got the number one choice. I mean,
exactly.
Who do you think they're looking at?
I'm going to go out on a limb here and say it doesn't matter who they're looking at, because I don't think they're going to exercise that pick as a pick. I think what they're going to do is wait and see what other teams are willing to give up in order to get that pick. The Celtics will get perhaps somebody who's an established top flight player now and trade the pick to a team that's trying to rebuild.
I see.
That's my guess, and it's only a guess.
Okay.
Because so far what Wick Grosbeck has said can be interpreted either way. He said at one point after they got the number one pick, he said, I wish the draft was tonight. We could get some help for the series against Cleveland. But then a little later on the same occasion, he said it's very likely that we will just have to wait and see how this all turns out, depending on what other teams offer us for the number one pick. And I think the latter estimation of circumstances is probably the more accurate.
Okay, so but what about some of the stars coming out of college hoops, right? Like UCLA's Lonzo Ball?
I laugh because he comes with so much baggage, including trying to sell a $500 sneaker.
His dad's $500 sneaker.
Yeah, I know, but his dad would have nothing if he didn't have all these accomplished basketball-playing sons. Some people think that this is wonderful because it's stealing the thunder of gigantic corporations like Nike. And some people think it's just ridiculous because $500 for a sneaker is inherently ridiculous.
I was just going to check under the table because I can't see your feet there.
You're not going to find any $500 sneakers. No, I'm one of those people who understands that wearing the shoe of an NBA player does not necessarily make you strong, young, and tall.
Yes. Sadly, neither none of those things
happen,
are
so,
we.
No,
yeah. Okay. So let's talk about the actual game tonight between the Celtics and the Cleveland Cavaliers, Game 1 at the Garden. Here's Isaiah Thomas talking about what they've got to do.
Everybody on that team is playing at a high level, so it's going to be tough, but we're here and we're ready.
But here's the thing, Bill. The Cavs are even more ready, right? They haven't even played in a week.
Yeah. This is one of those things that you can look at either way. I mean, LeBron James is on the record as saying he doesn't like long delays. And I guess the theory there is that your team gets a little bit stale, a little bit rusty, failing to, you know, have a competitive opportunity every few days. My feeling is that at this point in the NBA season, every player is likely to be so beaten up that a few days off, 7, 8, 9 days off, is a blessing. And the Cavaliers are going to have an enormous advantage because they're going to come into this series rested and healthy. And the Celtics are coming into this series having had to really battle through a 7-game series and a very tight 7th game to get here. And so they're going to be okay. And the other side of the equation is, oh, they're riding that momentum of, you know, getting the win in the 7th game, and they're going to go right into the series against Cleveland and beat them. This is why they play the games and why people watch them to see which is going to happen. But I would have to say the rest at this particular point would be a fairly substantial advantage.
Well, since we're talking about basketball, there's one last thing I have to ask you about, and that's the fact that you had the chance recently to sit down with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. We stole a little tape from your studio, and I just want to play it. Here's Kareem talking to you.
Here you have two people that are very unlike on the surface, but we ended up being kindred spirits.
Just got a couple seconds, Bill. What's he talking
He's
about?
He's talking about John Wooden, of course, yeah. Who coached him at UCLA. And his most recent book is about a long friendship that he had with John Wooden. And it's a great read, and I hope people will enjoy Kareem's presence on our program on Saturday.
I can't wait. Bill Littlefield is host of NPR's Only a Game. You can hear it, as Bill said, every Saturday on WBUR at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. and on Wednesdays right here at Radio Boston. Bill, thanks as always.
Thank you, Meghna.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.